On this episode of Women Behind Bars.
He had a butcher knife in there. He grabbed that, put it up to my throat, said he was gonna cut my effing throat.
She had what appeared to be dry blood underneath her fingernails. And then when you remove the socks, you could actually see blood in between her toes. Dried blood.
Then Marion Faye Kaysen tells her story. She is convicted of murder in the death of her 2-year-old daughter.
The doctors immediately notified the police that this looks like a classic case of an abused child.
I laid my head down and cried. No, she's not dead. No, she's not dead.
Two women, two brutal crimes. These are the stories of Donna Buchanan and Marion Faye Kaysen. On October 7th, 2000, a 911 call led police to the home of 80-year-old Charles Gouveia, where his lifeless body lay on the blood-stained floor.
Charlie got stabbed a total of 54 times, both to the back and to the chest, as well as to the head.
Gouveia's 37-year-old live-in girlfriend, Donna Buchanan, quickly became a suspect in the murder.
He had been threatening to kill her for quite some time.
If I had the choice of being with him, or going to prison for the rest of my life, I would choose prison. That's just how bad it was.
Investigators believed Buchanan's drug addiction was the catalyst for the fight between Donna and Charles the night he was killed.
We believe that the argument escalated to the point where she took a knife and stabbed him multiple times so she can get her drugs that she desired.
Did Donna Buchanan fatally stab her boyfriend in a drug-induced rage, or was it self-defense?
I grew up in Portsmouth till probably about 8 years old. Then my family and I, we moved to Cumberland, Virginia, and they had bought a farm.
Donna was 4 years younger than I was, and she was like the child that was always getting into something.
One of my best memories is Christmas and going camping in the mountains every summer.
But Donna says the good memory stopped at age 12 when her relationship with her father began to deteriorate.
About that age, it seems like men started paying more attention to me, older men. The first one was 18 years old. I was about 12 or 13. After him, the next one was 26 years old, and I was probably 13. I ended up running away with him. We've gone, I think, 2 or 3 days. And then he brought me back.
My dad had him arrested because she was too young to be having sex. And he was married.
And that's when my animosity started towards my father, because there was no sex between us. I was still a virgin, so there could be no statutory rape. So I was very upset.
A depressed teen, Donna was sent for counseling, where she says a doctor gave her a prescription for sedatives. At 13 years old, she began her lifelong habit of using drugs.
I think that was my way of also self-medicating myself. Smoking pot, drinking, I just really didn't care.
Donna would ditch classes and disappear for days at a time.
Next thing I knew, Donna had run away. She went to school one day and never come home.
That caused a lot of distress in the family. We didn't know where she was. Then somehow she came back.
When Donna was 14, she claims an incident occurred that drove her away from her parents' home for good and fueled her desire to do drugs.
My brother-in-law picked me up from school, took me about to Richmond, which is about close to 60 miles away from home. He ended up raping me, and that's how I lost my virginity, was by his rape.
At first, Donna kept the alleged rape a secret.
I blame myself. I guess that's what most children do when something like that happens. After that, I remember thinking there was no sense to go back home. I didn't know what my father would think. So my thought was, you know, just run away.
She just skipped school and eventually just got out on the road and started hitchhiking.
Hitchhiking to Texas and back to Virginia.
She hitchhiked to Florida. That's where she stayed.
Having nowhere else to turn after living on the streets, Donna moved in with her sister in Fort Lauderdale and the husband who Donna claimed raped her 2 years before.
That didn't work well. My sister was pregnant at the time. There was a lot of friction between me and her.
Donna told her sister that her husband had raped her 2 years earlier. Debbie didn't know what to believe.
To her, you know, every person that came into her family's life, she thought that person had raped her. I honestly don't know if anything happened with Tommy or not.
But it was Donna's wild ways that drove the sisters apart.
I was doing a lot of drinking and doing drugs.
There was drugs found in my house, and I told her that I don't want any of that around my family, you know, and you're just gonna have to move out. So she moved out.
Buchanan spent her late teens shuttling around Fort Lauderdale, living in shelters and on the beach. Her drug use escalated even further.
She survived on the street, as many young runaways do, trading their body for whatever they can get that helps them to survive. Heroin, other drugs.
Donna has been arrested numerous times in the past for drugs. She also has been arrested for prostitution. She's been arrested for heroin possession, cocaine.
Donna continued her drug habit into her 20s while living with various boyfriends.
There's a lot of abusive relationships. A lot of beatings from men.
In 1991, Donna's mother, Linda, moved to Florida, and the two decided to rent a condo together.
After my divorce, and I moved there, and I lived with her briefly.
Their landlord was an elderly man named Charles Gouveia, who sparked a fast yet unlikely friendship with Donna.
He would come over, check on things. They started coming over more, mostly too, when my mom wasn't there.
Charles told Donna about his granddaughter, Tina Mancini, who committed suicide in 1986.
Charlie always wanted to talk about what had happened with his granddaughter. I reminded him of Tina. He used to tell me the things Tina liked to do and would call me Tina sometimes.
They became more than just friends, Donna and Charles. And I didn't agree with it, but there was nothing I could do about it.
In 1993, Donna moved out of the apartment she rented from Charles and moved in with him in a Fort Lauderdale suburb. She was 30 years old, he was 73.
There was a big age difference between Charlie and me. The age difference really never meant anything to me.
I think that with my sister having issues over the rejection from our dad, she was looking for an older man, someone who could take care of her, because she didn't know how to take care of herself.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
You don't stab a man over 50 times to protect yourself or because you're fearing for your life. I'm not buying it.
By 1993, 30-year-old Donna Buchanan craved stability after years of drug abuse and unstable relationships. Still dependent on drugs, she moved in with her boyfriend, Charles Gouveia, 43 years her senior.
When I was with Charlie, at that point, my addiction was very bad.
Donna maintained that Charles not only enabled her drug habit, he used it to control her.
He would give me pills. In fact, he would go to doctors, telling me he needed painkillers. He started even buying heroin for me.
And here was a man who said he loved her, but provided for her in a way that made him completely in control of when she woke up, when she went to sleep, where she went, when she left the house. He used the promise of drugs if she would behave, the removal of the drugs if she did not, that would basically made her a slave in just about every sense of the word to his whims.
He got a safe because he started getting so many bottles of pills. And of course, I didn't know the combination or have the key. He started calling me a drug addict, started putting me down for taking pills, but yet he's the one that's supplying the pills.
He had this thing about rescuing, you know, women in distress. So him taking in Donna and trying to change her ways, that sounds like my father, something that he would do.
According to Donna, Charles also saw the drugs as a way to bring in additional income.
And he also sold the narcotics he got. He was like, this is easy money.
There was all the signs of them selling the drugs out of the house. Everything from the receipts from the doctors and the fake prescriptions. For every prescription that was written, he would falsify four and go to four different pharmacies with it.
He started getting confused which pharmacies he was using, so he started making records of all the pharmacies he used, all the doctors he used, where he had refills and everything.
As Buchanan found herself increasingly dependent on Gouveia, the tension between them began to escalate.
This man was her friend. He was her support person, the person she went to for everything. And at the same time, he abused her terribly.
I remember getting up one morning, getting ready, and he asked where I was going. I said, I'm going to go see my mom, then before I go shopping. And that was the first time he hit me and told me, no, you're not going.
He would physically hit her. He would drag her by the hair. He would scream at her and threaten her.
Donna was so small that you didn't have to be very physically strong yourself.
I guess he was 80. He looked more like he was in his, you know, late 60s. He was always out working in the yard.
But Gouveia's family denies Buchanan's allegations of physical abuse.
I find it hard to believe he was abusive because the age he was at that time.
He was never physically abusive. He was just very verbally abusive, very scary. When he went on one of his rants, it was enough to scare a woman, you know, to fear for her life, even though he wouldn't hurt her.
Despite the alleged abuse, Donna could not seem to stay away from Charles.
Several times, Donna tried to escape, and Charles found her and brought her back. Now, Donna had the drug habit that was difficult for her, but she did try for rehabilitation.
I used to sign myself in and out of hospitals to get away from him. That was like a only place I could go that he couldn't go.
She had gone to our battered woman's shelter, I believe, several times. He had always managed to get her back in short order.
I think she kept choosing him because she was afraid of what her choice would be. She was afraid of going back on the street. She was afraid of getting off the drugs.
I planned to leave him to go to Virginia for him not to know where I was at. My sister and my girlfriend took me to the hospital. I stayed in the hospital, withdrew from the narcotics. I remember it was a very bad withdrawal, but I was able to do it. I was released, and I remember I had no place to go. My sister, I think, thought it was better for me to stay somewhere else, find, you know, like stay at the Salvation Army or do that. But that, to me, was like putting me back on the streets. I couldn't do it. I couldn't. So I went back to him.
Although Donna claims she never fought back, a neighbor witnessed otherwise.
You could hear them from inside the house. She just sounded like a crazy banshee out of control. And I would really never really hear him yelling.
My mother was worried that if Charlie didn't kill my sister was going to kill him because it was just so ugly there at the house, the way that they were treating one another.
For 2 days, I hadn't slept. I remember he was playing a lot with the pills. Here, take these, there. No, you're not going to take them anymore. So I was like half in withdrawal, half out, yelling, fighting, hitting. The last day, I went to the bedroom to go to sleep. A half hour later, he comes in there, starts yelling at me.
Apparently, he was working on the computer, and he was having a lot of trouble with it. And he dragged her by the hair to come in and help him.
He had a butcher knife in there. He grabbed that, put it up to my throat, said he was going to cut my effing throat. I told him at that point, go ahead. He didn't. So I went back to bed. But when he came back in the second time, he was in a rage. I felt then that he was going to kill me.
Donna, like most battered women, reacted to the moment. It was never planned. And it was her attempt to survive, to protect herself.
When we got to the office that time, I reached for the knife, and that's when I stabbed him. I stabbed him repeatedly. I guess I snapped, I don't know.
Donna Buchanan stabbed 80-year-old Charles Gouveia 54 times.
Women who are abused, one of the ways that they survive is that they go into what we call a dissociative state. That is, their mind and their body sort of get separated and they're on automatic pilot. And I believe that's what happened with Donna. The overkill or the numerous stab wounds are because once you start in that stage, you can't stop.
You don't stab a man over 50 times to protect yourself or because you're fearing for your life. I'm not buying it.
I guess I felt that if I didn't kill him, he'd kill me. At that point, right at the end, all I felt was fear.
When Women Behind Bars continues,
I was being charged with murder in the first degree. I felt I deserved everything I got.
And later in this episode of Women Behind Bars, Marion Faye Kaysen tells her story.
They told me that she had died. I was just in shock. No, she's not dead. No, she's not dead.
On the night of October 6, 2000, 37-year-old Donna Buchanan, who was addicted to drugs and painkillers, fatally stabbed her 80-year-old boyfriend, Charles Gouveia. According to Buchanan, Gouveia, who allegedly had a pattern of abuse, held a knife to her throat and threatened to kill her. In the immediate aftermath, Donna panicked.
First thing I thought about was killing myself.
Her solution was to take as many pills as she could and to hope that that would solve the problem once and for all. That didn't work, so she, really in desperation, just started making phone calls to different people, not quite knowing what to say.
I talked to my girlfriend, my sister, my mom on the phone.
When she called the night it happened, I could tell she was on drugs. She first told me she'd just got home and something happened to Charlie, that someone had stabbed him. And I couldn't make any sense out of her. I said, Donna, you didn't go anywhere. Because he never let her go anywhere. She said, don't worry, Mom. I changed my clothes, but I left them in a pile. I told her to call the police.
I kept telling him, don't worry, I didn't mess with the crime scene. They'll be able to tell what happened.
I contacted the Broward County Police and let them know that there was a concern.
911, do you need police, fire, or medical rescue?
Yes, ma'am. My sister lives in Florida. I'm calling from Virginia.
Okay.
Her name is Donna Buchanan. The situation is this. A friend of hers, who's been on the phone with her, it said that Charlie is dead, that he was murdered. My sister came home from the drugstore and found him and would not call the police. But my sister is also trying to commit suicide as we're speaking. She's overdosing on medication.
The call came in after midnight, probably in the area of 12:40 a.m. I was dispatched as a backup unit.
When deputies arrived, Donna Buchanan told the deputies that she was fine, that she wasn't going to overdose on pills, and that Charlie Gouveia was in Stuart, Florida, working.
We asked her if we could look inside the house.
That one room had a door closed, and she refused to let him in. The deputy backed out of the house and began to look around the windows into the interior.
And we noticed that all the awnings were up except for on the front bedroom, on the side of the house. That was the only one that was down. We found that to be kind of strange.
They opened the awning, looked inside, and that's where they saw Charlie's bloody body inside that room. The murder occurred in this room here in the front, the home office.
Now, Donna became a suspect. Detectives took her to the Broward County Sheriff's headquarters for questioning.
I don't remember a lot from that point on.
She appeared upset, but yet really wasn't crying outwardly, wasn't showing emotion.
Donna was wearing a robe over a set of pajamas. She was disheveled and she was out of sorts.
She had what appeared to be dry blood underneath her fingernails, and then when you remove the socks, you could actually see blood in between her toes. Dried blood. Her story initially to us was that she went out and that she took her dog for a walk, came back to the residence and found the door ajar.
So now, when you get back in the house, what do you do?
I asked for Charlie. Charlie, where are you? So I wasn't there. And Charlie was laying on the floor.
What did you see as far as him laying on the floor?
His face there, and his eyes were open, and blood was coming out of his mouth.
I said, Donna, we have three versions of what occurred. We need to know the truth. We need to know what happened. She looked at me with great interest, and then she gave a fourth version.
And he reached for the knife, and I reached for it, and I got it first.
What happens once you said you got the knife first? What happens then?
He started fighting with it, and it struck him.
How many times did you strike him? Several?
Several times.
We then transported her to jail, where she was booked for murder in the first degree.
Meanwhile, investigators processed the crime scene.
Inside the room, Charlie had been stabbed 54 times, both to his back, his chest, and even to his head. There was blood all around his area where he was at. She subsequently took off her bloody clothes, placed them on the ground, along with the bloody knife that she used to stab Charlie.
And detectives also found evidence of the extent of Donna's drug habit.
We discovered a safe that was in the home office. This is right near where Charlie was killed. In the safe was two white boxes. One box said Xanax, and the other box said Lorset. The safe was open, both boxes were empty, and there were pills that were strewn on the floor near where Charlie lay.
Donna awaited her fate in the Broward County Jail.
I was being charged with murder in the first degree. My options at that time, I didn't really care. I felt I deserved everything I got. I just wanted it to be over.
The state was still seeking the death penalty against her.
Buchanan's defense attorney brought in top psychologists in the field of battered women to evaluate Donna.
Donna was psychologically in very great distress.
All of her test results showed a pretty serious impairment of brain function. Donna Buchanan had four strikes against her. There was neuropsychological impairment, there was a history of mental illness, there was a history of drug abuse and a history of being severely abused.
While Donna's legal team felt they had a strong case of self-defense, the police had a different theory.
We believe what happened that evening inside that residence is that Donna, who's been on prescription drugs for years, was having an argument with Charlie about getting more drugs. We believe in anger and rage that she stabbed him to death so she can get the drugs that were contained within the safe. That's what the evidence suggests, and she's using self-defense to minimize what she did.
The defense believed that bringing Donna's case to trial was risky.
Because of his age and the fact that he did have some physical frailties, we were concerned a jury might feel that she was physically superior to him and really didn't need to use the level of force that she did to repel his attack.
I didn't know if I wanted to take it to trial. Didn't know if I could handle a trial. I felt like I wasn't strong enough. So the state attorney offered me a plea, 15 years. I took it. At that point, if she had offered 25, 30, 40, I would have took it. I didn't care.
Donna is currently serving her sentence at Gadsden Correctional Institution in Quincy, Florida.
It's been a learning experience. It's given me a chance to look at myself, look at my life, look at my future, what I want for my future. I wanted to use my time in prison to educate myself, to give myself a better chance to, when I get out, that I can take care of myself. Never have to depend on a man again.
Donna is taking an industrial drafting class and also tutors young girls.
She's so interested in learning now and teaching and helping others. To a lot of them there where she is now, she's like a mom. They call her mom.
I like who she is without the drugs. She's come a long ways from where she started.
Yeah, still got a ways to go. But I'm working to make myself stronger on that. I don't have no reason to ever pick up a pill again.
Despite the progress she's made, Donna still thinks of Charles every day.
I don't think there's one day I don't wish I could tell him I'm sorry, but I can't. That has been more of a punishment than prison ever could be.
My father was miserable to live with, but he didn't deserve to die. I guess she got what she deserved, but as a woman, I just feel bad.
Next up on Women Behind Bars, a mother faces murder charges in the death of her 2-year-old daughter.
My knees buckled and I just started crying. I couldn't do anything else. It was not going to change anything.
For more information about Women Behind Bars, go to www.wetv.com. On the morning of January 2, 2003, police and emergency services responded to a 911 call that 2-year-old Serenity Nicole Miller was not breathing. When baby Serenity arrived at the hospital, the ER doctor immediately noticed that she had been dead for 2 to 3 hours.
Well, the autopsy showed all this bruising, trauma to the head, and she was suffocated.
Police focused their investigation on Serenity's mother, 24-year-old Marion Faye Kaysen, who had a history of self-mutilation, and her roommate, 40-year-old Frederick Stiegel, a convicted child abuser.
The mother really showed no reaction at all. It was almost like she already knew what happened.
But Marion claimed that Serenity was perfectly healthy when she left the house that morning, and that her death must have been caused from injuries from a fall 3 to 4 days earlier.
It was horrible just to find out that I had just seen her that morning, give her a kiss goodbye, told her I loved her, and then she's gone.
My theory of the case was that either she did it herself, or she knew that Stiegel had done it and was an accomplice.
Did Marion Faye Kaysen participate in her child's death, or did she unwittingly allow a convicted child abuser to murder her daughter?
She was really quite a normal kid, except for being a tomboy and loving to climb trees.
I spent a lot of my childhood playing make-believe.
She was happy. She was adventurous. For a while, she was just kind of an only child.
That changed when Marion was 11. Her brother Billy was born, and suddenly the family's attention was on him.
I wasn't really keen on the idea of having a baby around the house. But once I got to really start paying attention to him, and he really stole my heart.
The following year, the Kaysens moved to Live Oak, Florida. At Suwanee High School, Marion struggled to belong.
High school was very weird, because everybody's trying to find that little clique that they fit into.
But she liked, reading, and she liked ROTC.
Marion also began dating, but at a young age, started a dangerous trend of trusting bad men.
I was raped when I was 14 by an ex-boyfriend because he got mad at me because I dumped him.
She blamed herself. She was depressed, and she had at one point mentioned, that maybe if she committed suicide, the hurt would go away.
Kaysen coped with her internal misery by self-mutilating.
I would cut because I didn't know how to let the feelings go.
Marion did her best to put the pain behind her, but could not break her patterns. When she was in the 11th grade, she tried to escape by marrying her high school boyfriend, James Foley.
We dropped out of school, getting married, moving to Connecticut, and starting a whole new life.
But the couple split after just 6 months, so Marion returned to Florida and married another high school friend, Jimmy Miller. Soon after, she discovered she was pregnant.
They said, it's a little girl. And I was so excited.
Serenity Nicole Miller was born on January 30th, 2000. Marion was enamored with her new daughter.
She grew up to be a very, very, very beautiful little girl.
She was just so full of life that you couldn't help but just bubble over if you got around her.
Marion loved being a mom and was thrilled to learn she was expecting a second child.
I used to just love sitting there and Serenity'd have her head on my belly. Then I'd just sit there and snuggle.
On August 29th, 2001, Marion gave birth to a son, Joshua Miller. But the happiness was short-lived. The following year, she learned that her husband was arrested for a lewd and lascivious act upon a child under the age of 16.
When he went to jail, I sat down and talked to his mom. I said, look, I'm going to divorce Jim. My kids deserve better. And that's when all the mess started in.
Suddenly, Marion found herself a single mother of two young children with a husband in jail for child abuse. She got a job at a fast food restaurant to support her family, but still struggled to make ends meet.
You're sitting there trying your hardest to provide for these children.
Desperate for financial aid, she went to the Department of Child and Family Services. They placed her in a government-subsidized housing project in Live Oak.
The apartment was right in the middle of Cracktown. Well, at that time, I had no choice.
Craving male attention and support, the single mother befriended Frederick Stiegel, a co-worker at the restaurant.
I asked him, I said, look, I have two small babies and I need somebody there helping me. And he said, okay, I don't mind.
Stiegel moved in with Kaysen and her kids. Marion says she felt more secure having a man in the house and that the relationship was strictly platonic.
Mrs. Kaysen said no, that he was just a roommate. According to him, they were romantically involved.
Kaysen turned a blind eye to more than just their relationship.
He told me one night that he had been to jail for fighting.
Frederick Stiegel had several charges of grand theft, burglary, aggravated stalking, and aggravated child abuse. He had already served time in prison for aggravated child abuse.
He had just gotten out when he met Miss Kaysen.
Kaysen claims she did not know about Stiegel's criminal record for child abuse, but prosecutors maintain she had been warned.
Children and family went to Miss Kaysen and told her in no uncertain terms that Mr. Stiegel could be around those children, and all indications at the scene were that he was living there.
Marion denies receiving a warning about Frederick and says that she never saw him hurt her kids.
I didn't dawn on me that, you know, he might be a bad person because the kids are like him, and, you know, they call him Uncle Fred and all that.
And she was too protective over her kids to let somebody, you know, come into her house that she knew had been in trouble.
I told him my no-hit rule. I don't believe in spanking.
Kaysen maintains her daughter never had any bruises, and that she can only recall one injury when Serenity fell out of bed 3 or 4 days before she died.
She dropped her sippy cup coming down off the little rails. She hit, bumped her head. She had a little bruise right here, and that was about it. I got up that morning. The kids were already up, fed them some cereal. I left the house. Serenity was doing fine. Her little nose was just a little runny.
Kaysen chose to trust Frederick Stiegel to watch her kids while she ran errands.
After she left, he said that he put Serenity in her bed because she was crying and whimpering. And a little while later, he goes back to check on her. And she's unresponsive, unconscious.
Stiegel carried Serenity next door to ask for help.
It was 11:13 in the morning. A 911 call came in. 4 minutes later, the first responders are arriving.
The EMS workers had the child in the back of the ambulance doing CPR. I could see the bruising on the child's forehead and around her eyes. I reached out and touched her hand. She was very cool to the touch. I seen Frederick Stiegel standing there holding another small child. I approached him, asked him what happened. And his initial response to me is, there ain't been no child abuse here.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
I wasn't even home. And I felt if I didn't do it, then I should prove myself. And I tried.
We had eyewitness accounts of Miss Kaysen physically abusing little Serenity when she was only 6 weeks old. And this lasted throughout her lifetime.
On January 2, 2003, 2-year-old Serenity Miller stopped breathing and was covered in bruises. Serenity was rushed to the emergency room just as her mother, Marion Faye Kaysen, arrived home.
Police officer walked over to me and he says, we had to take her to the hospital. She wasn't breathing.
The mother really showed no reaction at all. It was almost like she already knew what happened.
And I really wasn't paying attention because I was so shocked.
Here you have a mother whose daughter has just been carried away. And Miss Kaysen does not ask what happened.
At Shan's Hospital in Live Oak, doctors tried in vain to revive Serenity.
The emergency room physician noticed that this child had been dead between 2 and 3 hours.
About 4 o'clock that afternoon, they told me that she had died. I laid my head down and cried. I was just in shock. No, she's not dead. No, she's not dead.
The doctors immediately notified the police that this looks like a classic case of an abused child. It didn't take long to center the investigation in on two people. And one of them is Marion Faye Kaysen, and the other was a man named Frederick Stiegel.
Marion's roommate, convicted child abuser Frederick Stiegel, had been watching Serenity and her 1.5-year-old brother, Joshua. The Department of Child and Family Services intervened on behalf of Marion's little boy.
Joshua was placed in foster care until the investigation was completed.
Kaysen agreed to help the police with their investigation of Stiegel. She participated in a recorded phone call with the intention of getting him to confess.
I'd like to know the truth.
I know you don't blame me either, do you?
I'm not blaming you for anything. And basically, they're telling me, you know, that I beat my child to death.
And they're asking me that I took my fist and literally beat her in the head. That's what they're saying I did.
You didn't, like, whip her or anything, did you?
No, I didn't whip her. I didn't do nothing to her.
I cooperated with whatever they wanted me to do. I couldn't get nothing out of him but 3 different stories on how he had found Serenity.
As investigators continued to view Marion as a suspect, they searched the residence she shared with Stiegel.
It was nasty. There was dried food and toys and stuff scattered all over it. It was very unkept.
Inside the children's bedroom, the investigators noticed that one of the beds was broken, that there was a blanket on it and a piece of cardboard, and indications that someone was still using that bed.
Despite the unsightly conditions of Marion's home, it was her journal that most disturbed investigators.
We found this poem that turned out to be written by Marion Faye Kaysen. Now, Serenity died on January the 2nd, 2003. This poem is dated January 1st, 2003. This poem is entitled Dark Side. I see myself taking their life. I could do it without strife. I can see the blood run red. I giggle as I bash in their head.
Marion denied the poem had anything to do with Serenity's death.
And I said I was just really upset about the bad things that had happened in my life. I was so depressed at that time that I knew if I didn't write out my feelings, I'd go back to cutting. It was a pretty bad poem, but it wasn't directed at nobody.
In addition, Serenity's body was sent to the state medical examiner's office in Jacksonville. The findings corroborated the detective's suspicions.
Well, with the evidence, we could say that this is a child that didn't die a natural death. This is child abuse, most likely smothering, but certainly there's head trauma as well. We're seeing all these injuries and died really of an injury of a swollen brain.
Miss Kaysen's statement to the police was, no, I did not hit her and I've never hit her. And the only way I can explain those bruises on her is that she fell out of the bed a few days ago. So basically her story was consistent with Mr. Stiegel's.
The medical examiner's office did not see those injuries occurring from falling from a bed.
On July 28, 2005, Kaysen and Stiegel were indicted by a grand jury for felony murder in the first degree, along with charges of child abuse and neglect. Kaysen was arrested and placed in the Sewanee County Jail.
I didn't understand why it had come to this. My attorney told me it wasn't going to come to that. It was just shocking. I was blown away.
Because of his previous criminal record for child abuse, Frederick Stiegel chose not to stand trial.
Once you've done something that stays with you no matter what, and if something else happens similar to that, you're marked for life.
I didn't do nothing. I wasn't even home. I felt if I didn't do it, then I should prove myself. And I tried.
So the timeline of this case is really one of the main pieces of evidence against Miss Kaysen. She indicated, when asked, that she had left the house at 10:56 that morning. At 11:27, we know Serenity is arriving at the emergency room.
When she's at the hospital, they noticed that really she'd been dead for 2 or 3 hours.
So by Mrs. Kaysen's own admission, that would have put her home when her baby died.
Kaysen insisted that she never harmed her daughter, but the prosecution presented evidence and testimony that proved Marion wrong on both counts.
We had eyewitness accounts of Miss Kaysen physically abusing little Serenity when she was only 6 weeks old, and this lasted throughout her lifetime.
Going back through the trial transcripts, I found out a lot of places where they have not told the truth.
On December 14th, after less than an hour of deliberation, the jury returned with its verdict, guilty on all counts.
My knees buckled and I just started crying.
Either she did it herself, or she knew that Stiegel had done it and aided and abetted him, or was an accomplice. And under Florida law, if you are an accomplice, you're punished the same as the actual perpetrator. So I guess the jury concluded that she was responsible for her death, and they found her guilty.
I was like, oh my God, this can't be true. But it was.
Kaysen is currently serving her sentence at Lowell Correctional Institution in Ocala, Florida.
I was so scared because everybody has their little horror stories about prison. I can't say that it's bad here. I can't say that it's good.
Kaysen has lost her appeals, but still maintains her innocence. She now believes Frederick Stiegel killed her daughter.
In my own opinion, because of what's been stated in trial, I believe that she may have started crying and he hit her and then he held her nose closed over her mouth.
Before Fred Stiegel came into her life, the kids did not have bruises.
Marion's son, Joshua Miller, is in the custody of his paternal grandparents. The whole ordeal has devastated the Kaysen family.
I loved that baby. I loved Josh. I loved my daughter. And it's all been taken away.
She was just at that age to where you could really have fun with her. And she was so adorable. We'd go to Walmart and look at the little dresses. Say, okay, next year she'll be big enough at this one. And then all of a sudden, those dreams just died. I know she's in a better place. I know she's not going to be hurt anymore. I know her pain is all over with.
It's hard. It's really hard. If I don't go back to court, if I don't win my case, I can't have my son back. I have to do what I got to do to get out of here, to get my son back, to show him that his mommy does love him, and that I'll never leave him again.